KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We have to stop this empire of evil.
Israel's President Isaac Herzog is calling for international support in destroying Iran's main nuclear facilities.
Today is Wednesday, June 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Trump's travel ban is impacting health research.
And some experts say the restrictions could harm U.S. interests.
We consider a stance and position because the world is a global village. We all need each other one way or the other.
And the NCAA will need to pay back nearly $3 billion to college athletes for their name, image, and likeness.
How might that settlement impact the college sports world?
As far as volleyball goes, I'm not worried. However, if this proposed settlement is accepted, there is danger of some sports being cut.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Trump administration officials are reported to again be meeting today amid escalating tensions between Israel and Iran and a continued effort by Israel to get the U.S. directly involved in a conflict there. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office today, Trump says no decision has yet been made on whether to strike Iranian nuclear site. They requested what he said previously, or repeated what he said previously about the situation.
I don't want to get involved either, but I've been saying for 20 years, maybe longer, that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. I've been saying it for a long time. And I think they were a few weeks away from having one. And they had to sign a document. I think they wish they signed it now. It was a fair deal.
Trump going on to say, in terms of Israeli military actions, Israel has done, quote, a very good job of that, but we'll see what happens. Iran's supreme leader has rejected calls for unconditional surrender. Israel continues to strike a wide range of military targets in Iran, but as NPR's Jeff Bromfeld reports, one facility remains out of reach.
Iran has set up a uranium enrichment site deep inside a mountain. It's called Fordow. David Albright is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He says Fordow is a key part of Iran's nuclear program that Israel must strike to achieve its goals.
If Fordow remains, then they haven't accomplished what they set out to do.
But the facility is buried beneath nearly 300 feet of rock, out of reach from Israeli weapons. The only bomb that stands a chance of getting through is a massive bunker buster owned by the United States. It remains to be seen whether President Trump will authorize its use and the U.S. air power needed to deliver it. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
President Trump is expected to sign an executive order this week that would extend by another 90 days a deadline for the Chinese owner of online video sharing company TikTok to find a buyer. The administration has repeatedly said that if TikTok is not sold, it will be banned in the U.S. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt this week says Trump does not want TikTok to go dark. The Federal Reserve has wrapped up its two-day meeting in Washington, leaving interest rates unchanged. Fed policy members also indicated, though, inflation could worsen in coming months, something that might cause the central bank to reevaluate. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell again said any moves in the future will be driven by data.
In support of our goals, today the Federal Open Market Committee decided to leave our policy interest rate unchanged. We believe that the current stance of monetary policy leaves us well positioned to respond in a timely way to potential economic developments.
There has been concern among Fed members President Trump's tariff policies could push up inflation. The Fed says for now, though, it expects two more interest rate cuts by the end of the year. On Wall Street, investors largely treading water today ahead of the Fed decision. The Dow was down 44 points today. The Nasdaq rose 25 points. You're listening to NPR. The Food and Drug Administration has approved lenacapavir for the prevention of HIV. Jonathan Lambert reports the twice-yearly shot provides near-total protection against getting an HIV infection.
Last year, HIV researchers were stunned by two clinical trials that showed lenacapavir was nearly 100% effective at preventing HIV, while existing treatments like pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP are also highly effective. They require people to take pills every day, which can be a challenge for some. Gilead Sciences, which manufactures the new drug, set a list price of about $28,000 a year. To provide more affordable options, the company is partnering with six generic manufacturers to provide access to 120 lower-income countries. But steep cuts to foreign aid could make it harder for this powerful new drug to reach those in countries with the highest HIV burden. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
A certain black bear in Michigan is probably feeling a whole lot better at the moment. That's after wildlife experts say they were able to trap the animal and remove a large lid that had been stuck around the bear's neck for 2 years. According to one wildlife expert, the fact the bear survived and was able to feed itself with the lid stuck over its head was actually, quote, pretty incredible. The bear with its added accessory was first spotted on a trail camera back in 2023. It was trapped earlier this month. The lid was successfully removed from its neck. No word on how it got there. Oil prices up for a sixth straight day as traders worry about possible supply disruptions due to Middle East turmoil. Oil gained 30 cents a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Will the United States attack Iran's nuclear facilities? President Trump said today he hasn't made a decision, but he's previously called for unconditional surrender. Israel has not publicly called on the U.S. to join its offensive against Iran, but today, in an interview with NPR, Israel's President Isaac Herzog called for international support in destroying Iran's main nuclear facilities. NPR's Daniel Estrin is on the line from Israel. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Juana.
What is it like to meet with the president of a country that's at war?
President Herzog said he's had some sleepless nights recently. We met in the president's official residence in Jerusalem. The streets around the residence were very quiet because of all the missile fire from Iran in the last several days. Just about 3 hours after I met the president, Iran launched more missiles at Israel. Here's what the air raid sirens sounded like. I should just say that the Israeli president plays a more ceremonial role, head of state. He did get a security briefing from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday, and he does play a diplomatic role behind the scenes.
What did he have to say about Israel's behind-the-scenes conversations with the United States about Israel's attack plans?
He said Israel was planning this attack for a few months, but the decision to carry it out was taken a few days ago. And that was after Israel shared with the U.S. intelligence he said Israel has about Iranian plans to produce a nuclear weapon.
I don't say that we got the approval from the United States, nor did we cooperate, but we've exposed to the Americans the hard intelligence and evidence that we have.
He said the U.S. did know for days that Israel was considering a strike on Iran, but this is the first time an Israeli leader is speaking so specifically about Israel sharing such intelligence that they say they had with the U.S. Now, we should note the director of U.S. National Intelligence testified in March that the U.S. intelligence community did not think Iran was building a nuclear weapon, but President Trump has dismissed that assessment.
Now, what did the Israeli president say about the U.S. joining Israel in attacking Iran?
I asked the Israeli president about that several times. I asked whether Israel would welcome U.S. involvement in Iran. He was very careful not to give a direct answer, but he said that he respects the president of the United States, and he said, quote, we'll just have to wait and see. He tried to make the case that Israel's campaign to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons capabilities was in the interest of the world and the U.S.
There's a bigger picture here that the world and the American people should understand. We have to stop this empire of evil no more and tell them, get the goddamn nukes out of your hands and start behaving in a decent way and not be the rogue state you are all over the world. It's impossible.
I want to add that I spoke with a person familiar with the matter, speaking on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the issue, who told me Israeli officials are not asking the U.S. to join in the attack on Iran, but Israeli officials would be happy for the U.S. to actively participate and think the U.S. will indeed take part with Israel in bombing Iran.
Daniel, would Israel need the U.S. to actually achieve its goal of destroying Iran's nuclear sites?
The president of Israel would not answer that question directly, but here's what he did say.
We are doing it alone, and we hope that there will be further support by other nations.
And about support by other nations, you know, military experts say Israel does not have the bunker-busting bombs nor the warplanes to pierce through Iran's most fortified nuclear facility, Fordo. The U.S. does have that capability, and so that's why the question of U.S. involvement is crucial.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin, who met with Israel's president today in Jerusalem. Daniel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Chief Diversity Officer was once corporate America's hottest job. Now DEI is under attack, leaving the people with careers in diversity, equity, and inclusion out in the cold. NPR business correspondent Maria Aspen brings us the story of one veteran executive who has been job hunting for almost a year. She reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Candace Birdsong Williams starts her mornings reading from the Bible on her bedside table. Then she turns to a daily devotional reading.
Today's was about keeping the faith, so it was really ideal. And
she's a pretty cheerful person. But during this conversation, she started tearing up.
We're not going to do this early into this interview. We're not.
She was feeling raw for good reason. Birdsong Williams has spent almost 20 years working as an executive in what's now known as Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, or DEI. She loves this work, and she's been doing it since 2007. She says she really fell for it after one interaction with a hearing-impaired colleague. The conversation got her thinking about the workplace barriers she'd never run into, and what employers could do to remove them for everyone.
Diversity runs so deep. It's not about the things that you can see, but it's about the things that you also can't see.
Since then, Birdsong Williams has worked for companies including Nationwide and Cisco. By last summer, she had worked her way up to the title of Global Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for a tech startup. But then she lost her job in a wider round of layoffs.
Being a single mom does bring on, you have to have resiliency. And, you know, immediately I was like, you know, it's going to be fine. And it is going to be fine.
Almost a year later, she's still trying to keep the faith. But she hasn't been able to find another job in DEI.
I've been in interviews and they're like, okay, we're no longer going to rehire for them. We're no longer going to staff this role. That's when I knew this isn't the same environment that it was years ago.
It really isn't the same environment. 5 years ago, the murder of George Floyd and the resulting public outcry sent employers racing to hire thousands of diversity specialists. Within 3 years, the number of DEI-related jobs in the United States had almost doubled. It was a great job market for experienced executives like Birdsong Williams, who told me on a Zoom call she was hearing from recruiters every week.
My inbox was completely on fire. Completely on fire.
But at the same time, a big backlash was gathering steam. Conservative critics argue that DEI is itself discriminatory, especially against white men. Here's the right-wing influencer Robbie Starbuck on CNBC.
We do believe in fairness, and I think that the workplace in corporate America has gotten way too partisan, way too divisive. We need to remove this stuff from the corporate America.
Even people who support DEI say that employers haven't always gotten it right. But they argue that, at its best, it creates more opportunities for everyone. Jeffrey Siminoff oversaw diversity initiatives from Morgan Stanley, Apple, and others.
The work of inclusion and diversity is actually making the workplace better for most people without taking anything away from any one or any group.
But as the backlash ramped up, some companies started backing away. Then President Trump was reelected and signed executive orders banning what he calls illegal DEI. Now dozens of private employers have erased even the word diversity from their public documents, and the DEI hiring chill is turning into a freeze. Paulina Tilley is a data scientist for the workplace analytics firm Revelio Labs.
Companies with DEI teams tend to have more diverse new hires. Getting rid of these DEI functions is really going to pare back the diversity of the workplace.
In the past 2 years, U.S. employers have eliminated more than 2,600 jobs related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's according to an analysis Tilly conducted exclusively for NPR. That doesn't mean everyone in those jobs has been laid off. Some employers just aren't filling roles after an employee leaves. And some companies have decided to call their DEI departments something else, like culture or belonging. But Tilly said employers aren't hiring as much for those jobs anymore either, which is keeping people like Candace Birdsong-Williams on the sidelines.
When you are directly affected by something, it really vibrates the ground. Like, it shakes and pulls the rug from up under your feet.
Now she's applying for human resources jobs that might not have diversity or DEI in the title. She's hoping that employers will focus on her skills and her 2 decades of experience. In the meantime, she's relying on her family and her faith. She keeps inspiration from them on display at her home, like a sign one of her daughters painted of a favorite Bible verse.
Psalms 46, he is within her, she will not fail. I'm not worried about failing.
Now she's just waiting for another employer to have the same faith in her and in the work that she's been so passionate about for decades. Maria Aspen, NPR News, Raleigh.
Deep in the Caribbean Sea off the coast of Colombia lies a treasure valuable for what it is and the history it holds.
More than 300 years ago, June of 1708, British forces attacked a Spanish treasure ship called the San Jose. This was during the War of the Spanish Succession.
The British were trying to capture the treasure on board, but the ship ended up sinking near Cartagena and the treasure was lost.
People had been searching for it because it was believed, and historical sources told us about this incredible, valuable cargo.
That is Daniela Vargas, a researcher at Columbia's Naval Cadet School and the National Institute of Anthropology and History. She says a group led by the Colombian government found the ship almost 10 years ago.
New images from the site tell the story of what was lost. She says they found
jars, pots, plates. We have seen some teacups of Chinese porcelain.
Gems, gold, and silver coins. They could be worth billions in today's dollars. But Vargas and her team are particularly taken with new images that show not just the coins, but what was engraved on some of them.
Castles and lions, the Jerusalem cross, and the columns of Hercules.
All markers of coins from Spain. They also found coins from Lima, Peru, and Bolivia.
When news first broke of the ship's discovery, countries around the world tried to claim the treasure, but Colombia's Ministry of Culture has designated the site a protected archaeological area.
Vargas said that her team doesn't want to see this as merely lost treasure, but an opportunity to learn.
It's a really rare opportunity to find this wreck and to study it. It can tell us a lot about what was going on around the beginnings of the 18th century.
No need to book a trip yet to visit. For now, all items will remain at the bottom of the sea while Vargas and her team continue to gather details.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's been 4 years since college athletes won the right to make money from their name, image, and likeness, NIL. Now, a landmark antitrust settlement will require the NCAA to shell out nearly $3 billion in back pay to current and former athletes dating back as far as 2016. But eight female athletes are appealing the settlement. It's estimated that around 90% of that back pay will go to men who have played football and basketball, which the female athletes say is a violation of Title IX, which bans sex-based discrimination in education. One of those athletes is Kate Johnson. She plays volleyball for the University of Virginia. When we spoke, she told me she believes this settlement, if approved in its current form, would impact women athletes for years to come.
If this is approved, then that is the future of college sports. And sports have played a pivotal role in my life. And I feel as though it is my duty to protect that for not only current female student athletes, but future. So this 90% not only affects this back pay, it affects the future of college sports. And that worries me for female athletes around the country.
What about the argument that men's basketball and football bring in the most revenue in college sports? Why shouldn't those players get more of the back pay?
I think that's a really fair question. I kind of have two answers for this. One, I would argue against the argument that these players are bringing in money to the school. So if a fan tunes in to watch, let's say, a UVA basketball game, they're doing so because they are fans of the University of Virginia or fans of the basketball program itself, not necessarily fans of a specific athlete over the other. Not to mention, these media deals were inked long before anyone really knew what athletes were going to play at what universities. Second, going back to Title IX, it's been the law for over 50 years. And the argument that some programs or people or sports should be exempt from this has been going on since Title IX was approved over 50 years ago. But schools are getting, once again, are federally funded and are getting a lot of money in order not to discriminate against women in this sense. If this money was coming from a private source, let's say a company like Nike, they could do whatever they want with it, but it's not. It's coming from a federally funded school and they must comply with Title IX.
What about the timing issue? Your appeal will pause the back pay, could stall payments for months as this plays out in court. Have you gotten any complaints that you're holding up the process for everybody else to get paid?
We've heard some complaints, and while they're valid, I think what I would respond with is that we want everyone to get paid, but we want these payments to be equitable. The appeal affects $1.1 billion of a $2.8 billion settlement. And so we aren't appealing over trivial amounts of money, and we understand the seriousness of the settlement. But the difference, like I mentioned earlier, is tens of thousands of dollars per athlete.
You know, among the questions that all is raising is whether sports that don't generate revenue could potentially be on the chopping block. The NCAA is raising questions about the price tag, whether all of this is going to bankrupt them. As somebody who plays volleyball, which is a fabulous sport, it does not bring in the money that college football does. Does that worry you?
I wouldn't say I'm worried that volleyball is on the chopping block necessarily. And I understand that sports like basketball and football have a greater viewership and bring in more media revenue for the school. But in a Power Four conference, almost every single one of our games is broadcasted on ESPN, ESPN Plus, or some other streaming platform. And so, and I make the argument that we are watched by more than just family and friends. Like, the Nebraska volleyball program filled an entire college football stadium. The Final Four for volleyball is being aired on ABC. And I think, as far as volleyball goes, I'm not worried. However, if this proposed settlement is accepted, there is danger of some sports being cut.
Yeah. Big picture, how are you feeling about the future of college sports? I know you've got just a year left, but it's been such a monumental time in college sports with the whole amateur student athlete model out the window at a lot of schools.
Yes, I think college athletics is navigating unprecedented change right now, and this House first NCAA settlement is the beginning of a new era for amateur athletics. And I'm not feeling uneasy, just interested as to how it is going to play out. And as far as this appeal goes, I think my biggest concern right now is the future of women's sports and making sure the same opportunities I've had to compete at such an amazing university is available for future generations of women.
Kate Johnson, she's on the University of Virginia women's volleyball team, and she is one of eight plaintiffs appealing the NCAA's $2.8 billion back pay settlement. Kate Johnson, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abdul-Rahman Edward Karoma was supposed to be in New York last week. The disability rights advocate was looking forward to talking about how disabled people are especially vulnerable to climate change at a United Nations conference, but he ran into an unexpected problem. He's from Sierra Leone, one of the countries on President Trump's travel restriction list.
It's quite painful and it's quite disappointing. And I hope the US government will really, really reconsider its stance and position, because the world is a global village. We all need each other one way or the other.
As NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains, Trump's ban will have a chilling effect on global health specialists like Karoma and could isolate the U.S. as well.
The disappointment felt by Karoma is shared by many others. The Trump administration has banned or restricted people from 19 countries from traveling to the U.S., citing security threats and concerns about visitors overstaying their visas. Yemen is on that list, too. That's a blow to one cancer researcher from the country who asked not to be named for fear of losing her job.
Not all people are bad. Those who are good, that can contribute to international community work, they can contribute in the scientific community. Having such, absolute restriction for all people, I think it is not wise.
She was supposed to come to California for a conference on cancer management this fall. She says not being able to attend will ultimately harm her work.
We need to have such participation. We need to have such contact.
And the impact isn't just on experts who live abroad. The United States will suffer consequences too, says Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Judd Walson. International collaboration is crucial to global health research, he says, especially when it comes to tracking emerging health threats.
Our inability to engage with partners from those places and really who can serve as eyes and ears on the ground to identify any potential threats, disease or otherwise, and then help us coordinate response, just hampers our ability to have a meaningful coordinated response and ultimately will harm us.
In a statement to NPR, the State Department said that individuals can apply for exemptions, but that they'd be rare. And 36 more countries, mostly in Africa, could be added to the list, according to a State Department memo reviewed by NPR. If that happens, Walson says the U.S. will become even more isolated from the global health community. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Some communities are scaling back Juneteenth celebrations because they worry about the risk of racial violence.
Given the nationwide climate, we are heavily about making sure that people are safe.
The challenges of Juneteenth and the latest on the war between Israel and Iran on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, The View from Tehran.
Thousands of Iranians are scrambling to flee the capital city as Israel's attacks intensify.
As days pass, fear, anxiety, and uncertainty are taking over.
That's ahead after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump's ambassador to Israel is sending what he calls an urgent notice to Americans who want to leave as Israel and Iran continue to fire rockets at each other. The State Department is working on evacuation flights and cruise ship departures, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
The U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem is closed for now, and some staff and family members have begun departing. Ambassador Mike Huckabee writes on the social media platform X that the embassy is working on evacuation plans for Americans who want to leave. He says Americans will be notified of flights or ships if they enroll in the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program, known as STEP. The State Department has set up a task force that's working around the clock, though officials here won't say how many Americans have reached out for help. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Senate passed a landmark bill to regulate stable coins, a type of cryptocurrency designed to maintain a fixed value by being pegged to the U.S. dollar. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the measure now moves to the House, marking a major step forward for crypto oversight.
Unlike volatile digital assets such as Bitcoin, stable coins are designed to offer price stability, making them attractive for payments and transfers. The bill would also create federal rules for how stable coins are issued and managed. The legislation passed the Senate 68-30, with a number of Democrats joining Republicans voting in support of it. Supporters say it brings much-needed clarity to crypto regulation. Critics argue more safeguards may be needed to protect consumers. And Democrats opposed to it say it does little to address concerns of presidential conflicts of interest because of President Trump's personal financial interest in crypto.
That's Windsor Johnston. You're listening to NPR. The Boeing, or the Bogong moth of Australia, travels more than 600 miles in the spring and then again in the fall. In Paris, Ari Daniel tells us researchers now know how the moths manage to find their way.
Previous work revealed that the Earth's magnetic field helps the moths orient.
But they couldn't use only the Earth's magnetic field. They needed something visual to go with it.
Andrea Adden is a neurobiologist at the Francis Crick Institute, and she thought that visual cue might come from the Milky Way. So she and her colleagues caught moths in the mountains and ran them through a couple of experiments, including one that involved placing them inside a mini planetarium with a projection of the night sky, and another that monitored the insect's brain activity. And they found the moths were using the star sky as a compass cue to orient and navigate, a first for an invertebrate. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Amazon is planning to jump into the autonomous race as it prepares to challenge self-driving taxi cab leader Waymo. Amazon's new factory near Silicon Valley here in California is gearing up to make 10,000 robo-taxis a year, with plans to start charging for rides in Las Vegas later this year. Waymo's robo-taxi service has been around since 2020 and served more than 10 million rides. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has rejected President Trump's call for unconditional surrender in the war with Israel, while the Supreme Leader hit a defiant note. Inside the capital, Tehran, streets are choked with traffic as people race to get out of the city to escape Israeli airstrikes. Many Iranians say they're scared, not only of the Israeli missiles, but of the future. NPR has been talking with several people in Iran. NPR's international security correspondent Jackie Northam has this report on what they're going through.
NPR began contacting Iranians shortly after Israel launched its first strikes against the country. We spoke with one woman, Zahra, a 30-year-old unemployed fashion designer from Hamadan to the southwest of Tehran. Like others interviewed for this story, she doesn't want her full name used out of fear of retribution from the government. Zahra, who spoke with an NPR translator, says she was overjoyed with the first Israeli strikes because they were killing senior leaders of the hardline regime. Zahra says that euphoria quickly passed as the missiles continued to rain down.
As days pass, fear, anxiety, and uncertainty are taking over. We don't know what we should do. We don't have internet. We have no access to reliable news.
Dina, a 48-year-old marketing specialist in Tehran, says an oil depot near her home was hit by an Israeli missile and was still burning. She says the Iranian regime is telling people to stay at home. Dina says when the Israeli military ordered parts of Tehran to evacuate, things began to move.
When the first statement from the Farsi-speaking Israeli military spokesman came out, Tehran got so busy. I mean, I left work at 2 p.m. There were kilometers-long gas station lines and heavy traffic on roads out of Tehran.
There are growing shortages of bread, flour, and other basics. Israeli missiles are hitting Iran's critical infrastructure, military installations, as well as residential areas. Sam, a 24-year-old university student, says the number of strikes seems to have slowed down, but are more intense.
As we go along and days pass by, there are reports of the killings of civilians and attacks on neighborhoods populated by civilians. Because of this, I experience fear and stress.
Sam says he's afraid what happened in Gaza, which has been devastated by Israeli airstrikes following a 2023 attack by Hamas, could also happen in Iran. He says the Iranian regime is not protecting people.
People of Iran, myself included, seriously oppose Islamic Republic of Iran government, and they don't trust the government, but they expect the government to have a minimum of defense power. Unfortunately, Iran has not been able to protect its people the way it should. We don't have shelters or anything of the sort.
Zahra, the fashion designer, says she's facing many mixed emotions about what comes next. She's happy the Israelis are targeting senior Iranian leadership, but her growing fear is that the country is destroyed, but the Iranian leadership somehow remains in place.
If all this destruction we are tolerating does not at least bring this government down and doesn't give people some power, they're going to torture us indefinitely after that.
And that an already paranoid regime, weakened by Israeli attacks, will crack down even harder on any sign of dissent. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The number of nuclear energy plants supplying electricity in the U.S. peaked more than three decades ago. Fears of another disaster like the one at Three Mile Island back in 1979 heightened concerns about the use of nuclear energy. Still, there are more than 90 reactors across the country, and they generate about one-fifth of the nation's electricity. Just last month, the Trump administration announced a series of executive orders with the goal of quadrupling nuclear power capacity in the U.S. by 2050. The state of Michigan could help reach that goal. Dustin Dreyer of member station Michigan Public reports that a closed nuclear plant there might be the first in the U.S. to be restarted.
Palisades Park is a lakeshore residential community in southwest Michigan. Karen Davis remembers spending summers there, sunbathing on the top of a dune when she was a teenager, swimming in the freshwater waves of Lake Michigan, down by the nuclear power plant on the beach next door.
The big draw at this end of the park was the warm water. People would go swim in front of the power plant because that's where the warm water is being discharged.
After 9/11, swimming in front of the plant was no longer allowed. Now there are signs along the beach and security in place. Davis says she started paying more attention to the plant when she was older and there were a series of safety issues. In 2003, she developed thyroid cancer. She says she didn't think a lot about it at first. Cancer happens. And then she says she heard from other cancer survivors about the link between thyroid cancer and radiation exposure.
That's when the light bulb went out in my head and I'm like, is it the power plant? Could it have something to do with that next door?
The state of Michigan said it looked into cancers at Palisades Park near the nuclear plant and found less than 6 cases from year-round residents, not enough to draw any conclusions. Davis says she's in touch with other residents to be a part of a new study. 6 years ago, she and her husband Bruce decided to move to Palisades Park permanently. They built their dream home on top of a dune almost as close to the power plant as you can get.
So why move to a place that you think gave you cancer?
Because that they were closing the plant. They were closing the plant.
They were, and they did. In 2022, the reactor shut down. But then the plan changed. Holtec International, the company that bought the plant to decommission it, decided instead to try to do something that's never been done before. Bring a decommissioned nuclear plant back online.
At first, it seemed daunting.
That's Neil Wharton, an engineer with Siemens Energy, one of the contractors hired to help inspect and repair a hulking turbine that now sits partially disassembled.
We got into a groove, it's not to be confused with being complacent. At no point do we feel comfortable, but we do feel confident and competent in the work that we're doing.
There is a lot of work to be done. There have been hang-ups along the way, most notably with the tubes attached to the steam generators in the reactor building. And the goal is to have the plant back online, generating 800 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 800,000 homes, by the end of this year, if regulators approve it. The Department of Energy is helping with a loan worth up to $1.5 billion. Steve Camello is with the EFI Foundation. The nonprofit supports low-carbon energy policies. He says restarting plants like Palisades is a good idea, but it won't be much of a factor in growing nuclear power.
You can count on one hand the number of sites where you can actually go and do these restarts.
Besides Palisades, there is one more restart project in the works. Constellation Energy has announced plans to restart Three Mile Island's Unit 1 reactor. It was not involved in the accident that occurred in 1979, but it was decommissioned in 2019. Now Microsoft has agreed to buy the power from the reactor for its data centers. Federal regulators are still considering approval for both of these plans. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Inflation is much lower than it was a few years ago, but that just means prices aren't increasing as fast, not that they're going down. Prices at the grocery store are still higher than they were before the pandemic. Along the U.S. southern border, some families find savings by grocery shopping in Mexico. Angela Cocherga reports.
In a brightly lit grocery store in Juarez, music sets a festive mood. Savvy shopper Diana Garcia is in the produce section looking for the best prices. The Juarez mother says she sees a lot of people from the U.S. buying groceries here. And more are doing so, Garcia says, because of the strong dollar to peso exchange rate. Stretching that dollar is a necessity for families coping with higher food prices on the U.S. side of the border. Cristina Castruita and her husband routinely shop in Juarez, which borders El Paso.
We've been doing it since the kids were babies, especially because the formula is half the cost in Mexico than it is in El Paso, and it's a better name brand too.
Castruita says now she shops for cheaper brand name laundry detergent for her boys aged 8 and 10. Her oldest son, Alfredo, chimes in with his own price-saving favorites.
A lot of fruits, they're bigger, less expensive, they taste better. The watermelons tend to be nicer.
Watermelons are allowed, but some produce is prohibited by the U.S. because it could carry agricultural pests. His mother says when it comes to fruit and other items, she likes the variety available in Mexico.
We buy a lot of things like yogurt because we have, not only is it cheaper, but we have really exotic and different flavors available.
The dairy section in most Mexican grocery stores is much larger. Other items the family buys?
We prefer Mexican ketchup also, and of course tortillas. We buy them in bulk and then freeze them.
Generations on the border have looked to Mexico for lower prices and a wider selection, and vice versa. Shoppers from Mexico also cross into the U.S. for certain items, including clothes and electronics. Tom Fullerton is a professor of economics at the University of Texas at El Paso.
That's sort of the holy trinity of retail economics, when consumers can have access to lower prices, better quality, and more variety.
A survey by the city of El Paso just months before the pandemic found local residents spend about $352 million a year on groceries in Mexico. Fullerton tracks the border economic outlook in this region in an annual report. He expects higher U.S. tariffs to affect shopping behavior all along the border.
From Brownsville all the way to San Diego, they'll cross the border and take advantage of lower prices as a consequence of what in effect would amount to a federal sales tax.
Beyond chasing cheaper prices, it's a way of life on the border. The kids get a haircut, the family enjoys a meal, and time with other relatives, all in Mexico. Castruita says there are many reasons to spend an afternoon across the border.
To save myself some money, to expose the kids to their culture, and just for fun. It's cheaper and delicious.
For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A federal judge is ruling this week that funding should be restored for about 800 terminated NIH grants, does not include the widespread cancellation of grants at Harvard University. More than $1 billion federal dollars that were awarded to Harvard but have not yet been spent are now unavailable. And as Craig Lamolt of member station GBH reports, some scientists say the cuts will have a devastating impact on critical research.
Jessica Chaikoff and her older sister Rachel were both born deaf. At the time, the family didn't know exactly why.
And so we pretty much lived our lives normally with cochlear implants.
But in 2006, when Chaikoff was just 11 years old, her older sister started having vision problems and was diagnosed with Usher syndrome type 1F. It's a rare genetic disorder that causes deafness at birth and then, over time, blindness.
My mom didn't want to scare me, but they knew if Rachel had it, I have to have it too because it's genetic.
Chaikoff's now 30 years old and a PhD student, and she gets around, especially at night, with the help of a guide dog, a yellow lab named Jake.
He's very quiet.
Chaikoff is hoping research into gene therapies could someday stop or even reverse the deterioration of her vision. But she worries cuts to federal research funding, especially at Harvard, could mean that therapy won't be ready in time to save her sight.
I don't want to go blind. And so that progression is really scary, especially when I see the cuts by the Trump administration on research funding, on Usher 1F research.
The Trump administration has said the termination of Harvard's grants are in part because of what it sees as the university's failure to address anti-Semitism on campus. Usher 1F, which is thought to affect somewhere around 10 to 20 infants born in the U.S. each year, is particularly prevalent in people descended from Ashkenazi Jewish populations.
I get really angry because the Trump administration claims they're protecting us. They're not. They are actively harming us, especially when you're attacking funds for Ashkenazi Jews, Jewish diseases.
Chaikoff's parents run a foundation dedicated to supporting the development of gene therapies for Usher 1F. In 2017, Dr. David Corey, a Harvard scientist who'd been studying the protein that's affected in these patients, met Jessica and her sister at a conference hosted by the foundation.
And it was really meeting the two daughters and seeing how well they're bearing up with the challenges of the disease that we said, you know, we might be able to contribute something here. If we don't, who else is going to do it?
Corey says they now have a good understanding of the protein that's defective in patients with Usher 1F.
Because we know so much about it, we could design strategies to deliver a normal copy of this protein first to the inner ear and then to the retina.
Corey says it's going to take more research before they're ready to begin human trials of gene therapy that could fix that protein in patients. He currently has two grant applications submitted to the National Institutes of Health.
But even if they are scored very highly by a review committee, it's unlikely that those grants would ever be awarded to Harvard. That will really slow down the research.
Already, some of his research has come to a halt. Corey had an NIH grant terminated that was supporting basic science into the genetic mechanism of hearing. The NIH did not respond to a request for comment.
To be at the verge of developing therapies, finally, for some diseases that we could only diagnose for decades, and then to have the rug pulled out from under us for the whole scientific enterprise, not just Harvard, is really discouraging.
Even so, Corey says he's optimistic Harvard's lawsuit challenging the federal funding freeze will be successful. He says when that happens, his grant applications will be there, ready for funding. Jessica Chaikoff's hoping he's right. She's confident gene therapies could work.
And that's the case not just for my disease, but for any rare disease.
As long, she says, as the federal funding is available. For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt in Boston.
All around the world. world, a toothy, furry plushie named Labubu is causing a frenzy. In this week's Word of the Week, NPR's Juliana Kim explores the meaning and story behind Labubu and what its popularity tells us about today's consumers.
It looks like a monster from Where the Wild Things Are, but when Hong Kong artist Ka Sing Lung created the character, he was setting out to draw an elf, inspired by the Nordic fairy tales he read as a child. Labubu is one of the characters in his illustrated book series called The Monsters that debuted in 2015. A few years later, Lung teamed up with the Chinese toy company Pop Mart, and from there, the plushie became a global sensation. They're kind-hearted and eager to help, though their good intentions can sometimes lead to chaos. Today, Labubu sparked long lines outside toy stores, sell out online within minutes, and resell on secondary markets for double or triple their original price. Last week, a life-size Labubu figurine sold for six figures in China, according to Yongle Auction. But what exactly is a Labubu? Well, it's a plushie doll that comes in a range of sizes, but the most popular are sold in so-called blind boxes, meaning what's inside is a surprise.
So I think it's evolved into something that feels like a very new phenomenon, but I feel like it probably has some roots in the Japanese lucky bags.
Michelle Parnett Dwyer, a curator at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, says those bags were full of leftover merchandise. She showed me a blind box toy she recently bought. It was from a series of classic Disney character plushies. The one she got was Daisy Duck.
Is that the one you wanted?
Yeah. Well, so yes. Yes, I wanted Daisy or Minnie. So
that's amazing.
I don't wear her on my bag yet. She's in the bag.
Okay.
She says there's been a long-standing fascination with mystery, like with cereal box prizes and capsule toys from vending machines, even trading cards such as Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh.
I think there's a lot of things where the popularity among adults or young adults stems from childhood nostalgia of, I want to have this little stuffy or this little prize. In a nostalgia-based.
Parnett Dwyer says reconnecting with your inner child is ultimately a good thing. It helps us have fun, engage with one another, and stay young. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
What happened after the first Juneteenth? At the site of a former plantation in Alabama, a white descendant and a black descendant of the families that once lived there have created a museum. Its new exhibit tells the stories of formerly enslaved people who were granted their freedom and not much else. That conversation tomorrow on All Things Considered. If you're not by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. And from the John D.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Let's go.
gonna hurt you like you hurt me.